Thanks for joining us. I'm Michelle Martin, host of Tell Me More, sitting in for Diane Rehm. When President George Washington died, he was eulogized as the Moses of his people. Washington was the first in a long line of American leaders to be linked to the biblical icon. In a new book titled America's Prophet, Moses and the American Story, author Bruce Feiler crisscrosses the U.S. to discover the influence of the Exodus story on American culture and history. Feiler meets with Freemasons who revered the Hebrew Bible, walks in the footsteps of a fugitive enslaved American on the Moses-inspired Underground Railroad, and climbs the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty with its mosaic tablet of law. And Bruce Feiler joins us now in the studio. Welcome. It's nice to see you.
Thank you, Michelle. It's great to be here. And as someone who wrote three books living in Washington, hearing that music brings a lump to my throat, I must say.
I know. It does to all of us. Now, your book is a lovely read, but it's easier to describe than to summarize, if that makes sense. So tell, you know, I understand the journey, but it's hard for me to describe what the journey was about. So tell me how you got started on this journey.
Well, I sort of stumbled into it. It was great to listen to your last hour where you were talking about Iran. I had spent 10 years, as you know, traveling around the Middle East, writing a series of books in which I was retracing the Bible through the deserts of the Middle East, walking the Bible, Abraham, then where God was born, which has a whole section which takes place in Iran. And I was spending more time in America. My wife gave birth to identical twin girls, as we just were discussing off the air. Parents of twins have a way of finding each other in a room.
It's true.
And so we were spending more time at home, and we were traveling. And so we went to see my in-laws who live in Boston. We stopped off in Plymouth. They have this recreation of the Mayflower. And I got on board, and there was a reenactor reading the Bible. And I thought, well, I'm Bible guy. So what are you reading? He said, the book of Exodus. We read it when we were sailing on the Atlantic. I thought, well, that's interesting. Here's Moses in the middle of Thanksgiving. I hadn't really ever made the connection. We went to Savannah, my hometown. There's a letter from George Washington on the wall of a synagogue that says he credits his success in the revolution to the same God who long since freed the Israelites. In Philadelphia, visiting my sister, turns out to be that quote on the side of the Liberty Bell is from Moses, proclaim liberty throughout the land. And I was really surprised by this, and I just kept finding it over and over. Columbus comparing himself to Moses. Ben Franklin recruiting him to pass the Constitution. You mentioned the Underground Railroad, the Statue of Liberty, Martin Luther King, of course, the night before he died. I've been to the Promised Land. I've seen the Promised Land. I will not make it, but you as a people will make it. And this sheer number of references was staggering and sort of sent me off on this journey, because for 400 years, one figure has been the surprising symbol of America. One figure has inspired more Americans than any other. His name is Moses. The story seemed essentially untold to me, and I did what I do, which is sort of to go out and to travel, and that kind of creates the sort of hybrid nature that you're talking about, which is one part adventure and one part history and one part detective work, trying to figure out, why has he inspired so many people, and can he be helpful in troubled times today?
Well, give us a sense of how many different people he has inspired and how different they are.
Well, I think that at its heart, in a certain way, America is about an idea. And it is about this idea that you can be in a difficult place, you can be in a challenging place, and you can go to a better world. And the person who really represents that more than any other is Moses. And if you think about it, I mean, today we kind of have a distance from the Bible. Is it true? Is it not true? You know, is it human hands were involved? For most of American history, that hasn't been the case. So when those pilgrims, they're living in England, they're feeling oppressed, then they're living in Holland. What do? They cross a tumultuous sea, they set out to an undeveloped wilderness, they're going to create a new promised land. And to them, Moses was a powerful precedent. Well, if he could do it, we could do it too. You move up to the revolution, the same sort of dynamic. So in the same way the pilgrims call King James the Pharaoh, Thomas Paine in Common Sense calls King George the Pharaoh. And for the colonists, they were, again, the most quoted book. These two scholars set out to read everything published in America between 1760 and 1805. The Book of Deuteronomy was the most quoted book. And on July 4th, I mean, I love this story. Who knows the story? On July 4th, 1776, immediately after passing the Declaration, Continental Congress asks Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, and John Adams to come up with a seal for the new United States. It was a Thursday afternoon, the last order of business. 6 weeks later, they make their recommendation. The seal should be Moses leading the Israelites across the Red Sea. These are three of the five drafters of the Declaration, three of the defining faces of America, and they think Moses should be the face of the new United States.
Well, there are a lot of great stories in the book, and I hope we'll get to as many of them as we can. Particularly, we have to hear about what it was like to wear Charlton Heston's robe from the Ten Commandments. We must hear about that. But if you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. You can call 1-800-433-8850. That's 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. So, who was Moses?
He's a man without a past. He's a man without a father. He's a sort of unknown figure because he's born into slavery in Egypt in the 13th century BCE, according to the book of Exodus, and at a time when the Israelites were threatening the Pharaoh. And his mother floats him down the Nile. He's picked up by the daughter of the Pharaoh, raised in the palace. So already we have the parallels with the current document of the White House are not insignificant here. You've got a fatherless man, you know, raised by adoptive parents. And his life, in a way, is sort of defined by a series of choices. And the first one occurs when he's an adult. He witnesses an Egyptian overseer beating the Israelite. What does he do? Does he cling to this life of luxury he's got? He's living in the palace. Or does he align himself with the suffering? As he does repeatedly in his life, he aligns himself with the poor, the hurting, slays the overseer, flees to the desert, hears this voice in a burning bush, in which God, I think of the voice, my wife doesn't like it when I say this, but I think of that voice as being like, Uncle Sam, your country needs you. And
A lot of people think of that voice as being Charlton Heston.
In fact, Charlton Heston, DeMille uses Heston's voice slowed to be the voice of God. So Heston not only plays Moses, he actually plays God in the movie too.
I don't understand why James Earl Jones never got a crack at that. I'm sorry. I think he's got one of the all-time great. You know, I would do what he said. But anyway.
He'd already given his voice to AT&T at that point. I don't know. Anyway, so Moses then goes back, walks up to his surrogate grandfather, let my people go. And then the 10 plagues come. He leads the Israelites across the Red Sea, at which point the kvetching and complaining begins, right? I mean, it's this incredible parallel to the birther movement. Who elected you over us? I mean, they don't ask for Moses' birth certificate, but they come very close. So again, a series of choices. What is he going to do? When he goes up and gets the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai, he comes back, they've built the golden calf. Is he going to, God says, you know what, Moses? These people don't appreciate me. Why don't we go get ourselves a new people? And Moses calms down God, reprimands the people, brokers this compromise. Off they go toward the promised land. He is this leader aligning himself with the suffering, trying to build a society that nurtures all of its people, but constantly squeezed between the people and God. I think because he's such a human figure, that's why he's so relatable. And I think that opens up the comparison with Jesus, who's kind of an other-like figure. Moses is, you know, he's got doubts, he's got anxieties. He's a real human person. That's why so many people have related to him.
Well, you can certainly see how the Exodus story influenced the anti-slavery movement.
Yes.
If you talk a little bit more about that.
Well, think about it. I mean, so as much as America was the new Israel, if you will, and that language was all through the revolution, there was a bit of old Egypt left behind. There was this slavery. And for slaves living in the South, as this one professor said to me, they didn't get news by reading the newspaper. They got it by reading the Bible. And to them, Moses was a powerful example. Well, he was enslaved. These people, he could be free. Maybe we could be free too. The number one theme of slave spirituals was the Exodus, take back Pharaoh's army, I'm bound for the promised land, and Go Down Moses, which I won't sing for you. It was called the national anthem of slaves. And you think of Harriet Tubman, who's the most famous figure on the Underground Railroad, born in Maryland, not far from where we are right now. She leads, you know, 12, 20, anywhere in their trips. And she's doing it following a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, just like the Bible. And she was called the Moses of her people. And so there were these wanted posters across the South saying, wanted Moses, dead or alive. So here we had Moses. The founders wanted him on the seal. Now they wanted him locked back up in shackles. So it was a powerful example for the slaves that there was another alternative.
You actually met is it an ancestor or a woman whose family knew Harriet Tubman?
There's this woman, Joan Southgate, God bless her, who was a social worker and a teacher in Cleveland, and she retraced the Underground Railroad. And her mother grew up in Auburn, New York, which is where Harriet Tubman later settles later in her life. And And she talks about, as a child, hearing these stories about Aunt Harriet. She would have epileptic fits late in her life. And the so it's just a reminder that this period in our history isn't that long ago. And the ability of this story, and you think of Martin Luther King using the story in almost all of his speeches, echoes back. And it's not that old, America. The story is very powerful today.
But one of the revelations from your book, and I thought I knew this, but I didn't understand this part of it, that both sides during the Civil War claimed the story, that you, both sides thought they were right and that Moses was on their side. And you say that the American Civil War was the war between the Moseses. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, because basically it was obviously the blacks, the northerners, the abolitionists used the story for obvious reasons. But the white southerners said, look in the Bible. Abraham circumcises slaves. Moses has slaves at the first Passover. Jesus does nothing to free slaves. They said, look, don't take our word for it. Take God's word for it. He really supports slavery. And that's why Lincoln was such a powerful figure, because he wasn't a religious person himself, but he was by far the most Bible-quoting president we ever had. And he stood up at that second inaugural. We worship the same God. We read the same Bible. And sure enough, you mentioned at the top about Washington, when he died again, two-thirds of the sermons compared Abraham Lincoln to Moses, because he had freed the slaves but stopped short of the promised land of victory.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will have more with Bruce Feiler and his very interesting new book, his latest book about the influence of Moses on the American story. And we'll be taking your calls and emails. Please stay with us. I'm Michelle Martin, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Welcome back. I'm Michelle Martin, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Our guest is Bruce Feiler, the New York Times bestselling author of 8 books. His latest book is America's Prophet, Moses and the American Story. And we're taking your calls. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And now we're going to take some calls. Let's go to Andrew in Cleveland. Welcome, Andrew. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I was wondering if your author had anywhere in his book touched on the parallels that have been drawn between Moses and Superman.
We are so glad you asked that.
Great question. Basically, we were just talking about Lincoln before the break, and after the Civil War, the Bible begins to decline in influence in America as secular language pops up. But what happens is that Moses sort of decouples himself from the Bible and enters the realm of pop culture, everything from books to movies to poetry to opera to, yes, comic books. And you're calling from Cleveland in 1938, two bookish Jews from Cleveland, Ohio, base their comic book superhero on the superhero of the Bible. So just as Moses is put into a basket, floated down the Nile to escape annihilation, baby Superman is put into a small spaceship, floated into space to escape extinction, both Superman and Moses picked up by aliens, raised in foreign environments before being summoned to assist humanity. And as you clearly know by asking the question, Superman's original name in Kryptonian was Kal-El, which in Hebrew mm-hmm. means swift god. So he was clearly designed to be a modern day god.
So aren't you glad you asked? Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah.
This is two shout-outs to Cleveland in the same 5 minutes, really. I mean,
Let's go to, is it Abubakar in Glendale, Maryland? Abubakar?
Yes.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, how are you?
Good.
First-time caller. I was trying to talk about the birth of Moses. Like in Islam, you know, Moses had a father. But, you know, Pharaoh was the king at that time. So when Pharaoh, I think Pharaoh's, people that look, you know, for the future for him, you know, suggested that, you know, if they have any, a baby boy's birth, you know, in, at that time, and that would take the kingship of Pharaoh. So because of that reason, you know, Pharaoh was trying to kill all the baby boys that were born at that time. You know, so when that happened, you know, and Moses' father was a member of Pharaoh's crew, you know, group at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So the mother got scared. So God sent him a message, you know, to tell the wife, you know, to throw Moses, you know, in the sea. So when that happens, you know, Moses sailed, you know, all the way to the to Pharaoh, you know. So that's how Pharaoh's wife, you know, grabbed, you know, Moses and said, okay, the sea has given a birth to a baby boy. No, so Pharaoh, you're not going to kill this boy.
But Abubakar, does the story have meaning to you? Does it have special meaning to you?
It does, because it's in the Quran, so it does have a meaning, yes.
Well,
what's interesting is that Moses, thank you for sharing the story in the Quran. Moses is actually the biblical figure most mentioned in the Quran, and he is mentioned all through the New Testament as well in comparisons between Moses and Jesus. But one of the interesting sort of things that I uncovered in the process of working on this book and why I call Moses America's prophet is his role in America is actually somewhat singular, because while he appears in the Hebrew Bible, Jews basically downplay Moses in favor of God. The Passover story, which celebrates the story of Moses is mentioned basically only in passing. So Jews tend to downplay him in favor of God. Christians naturally tend to downplay him in favor of Jesus. Muslims in favor of Muhammad. And so for most of human history, he was really somewhat of a marginal figure. That all began to change around the time America was being created, first of all, by the Protestant Reformation, because all through the Middle Ages, essentially the Catholic Church said you could only read the Bible in church. A priest had to do it for you, only in Latin, so you couldn't read the story directly. So now with the Reformation, people said, okay, the Protestant Church said, read the story directly. In fact, we'll give it to you in your own language. Second, the printing press, because in the Middle Ages, it took two monks 4 years to transcribe a Bible. There weren't even that many Bibles. Even churches didn't have them. So now everybody could read the story for themselves. And then you have this geographic element, as we talked about earlier, the fact that America was across a sea, undeveloped as a wilderness. So really, America is the first place to really make this connection. Even modern Israel today doesn't have this kind of affinity with Moses, because Moses, of course, never set foot in Israel. He was not in the Promised Land. So King David, Solomon, Judea and Samaria, these are more important, even Abraham, to Israelis, because they were actually people on the land. So I think the relationship between America and Moses is actually unrivaled any place else in the world.
We have placed his character front and center in a way that most other cultures have not. And one of the other revelations from your book, which I found fascinating, is that you write about how many American leaders and how many different American leaders have been compared to Moses. Betty Friedan, in her leadership of the feminist movement.
Yes.
Harvey Milk, the first openly gay city supervisor of San Francisco, was called the Moses of his people. You say that in 1987, Richard Cheech Marin made a film, Born in East L.A., likening Latino immigration to the Exodus. Fascinated by this.
What's interesting about this to me, Michelle, is that the story was introduced into America by white male Protestants. They're the one who made the connection. But because he was already living here, first blacks, then Jews, later women, all used, and then, as you mentioned, gays, feminists, other people, now immigrants today, are using the story to claim their place in the American narrative. And we're sitting here in Washington, D.C. You've got six representations of Moses on the Supreme Court, including the frieze outside, a painting in the House chamber, in the Supreme Court chamber. In the House chamber, the President of the United States stands to give the State of the Union. There are 23 bas-reliefs in the House chamber, 11 look left, 11 look right. One looks out directly at the speaker's dais there. That's Moses. There's Moses in the Library of Congress, in front of the Reagan building, in the National Archives, and nearly every president from Washington, Jefferson in his second inaugural, Lincoln, as we said, Wilson, FDR, Ronald Reagan. George W. Bush told me personally in the Oval Office he was inspired to run by Moses. Barack Obama, 3 weeks after announcing his candidacy, says he's going to be the leader of the Joshua generation, finally finishing the story of Moses. He's really an icon of American leadership, and he's sort of the patron saint of Washington, D.C.
I do have to ask, though, how much our conception of Moses as a character is informed by that most American of institutions, the movies.
Some of the earliest movies were made about Moses, actually, and because the movie makers wanted the films to be allowed to be shown on the Sabbath. And then DeMille made a 1923 Ten Commandments in which he actually flew out Hasidic Jews from New York to California. They were filming the movie because he thought they would be the most authentic to be the Israelites. And so he flew out these Hasidic Jews, took them out into the desert where they were filming, and put them in the mess tent and proceeded, and I'm not making this up, to serve them ham for dinner.
Oh, no.
So his authentic Israelites were very hungry Israelites. And when he and then
and
of course
they didn't have a ruckus like they did around the golden calf. Nobody started throwing things. Come on.
And in the 1956 Ten Commandments, which is the fifth highest grossing movie of all time, he really turned Moses into this icon of the Cold War. And that really, and so when you went to see the movie in 56, the curtain parted, and there was DeMille in a coat and tie. This is a 3-hour and 39-minute movie. He has a 5-minute preamble. This is about communism. If you live in the communist world, you can't worship freely. If you live in a democracy, you can worship God's will. And he uses this all the way through, so that the last scene in the movie, Charlton Heston hands over the Book of Life to Joshua, turns, quotes the Liberty Bell, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof, even though that's from the Book of Leviticus, three books earlier, nowhere near the death of Moses. And then Heston climbs to the top of Nebo, turns, recreates the pose of the Statue of Liberty, because the spikes of light around Lady Liberty's head and the tablet in her arms both come from the moment Moses comes down Sinai with the Ten Commandments.
So I have it wrong. The borrowing is going the other way.
The borrowing is going the other way. And DeMille marches, it's all very intentional, it's in his notes, he marches Moses through the great icons of American life until he becomes the symbol of America enlightening the world.
I have to ask about the robe. You got to put on the robe that Charlton Heston wore in the movie.
I applied to get permission to go to get to the DeMille estate. It's controlled by his granddaughter, who is still living today, a wonderful woman in California. She was actually on the movie in 1956 and had an affair, a much publicized affair, with Yul Brynner's chariot driver. It was actually quoted in Time magazine at the time. It was such a scandal. So she gives me complete access after I went through this screening, like kind of having an audience with the Queen. And I go in, and it's like going into your grandfather's garage if your grandfather had made 70 movies, right? So you've got, you know, chariot wheels and circus costumes, and there's a box that says Moses's robe. And this woman is showing me around. She brings it down, and she opens it up as if it contained the Shroud of Turin, wrapped in cellophane and protective paper. She opens it up, and it's burnt orange with brown stripes. And you said it, but don't tell anybody, I tried it on. I was kind of amazed by how well made. 50 years later, it was ready for another grueling shoot in the desert.
Stripes. How come I don't remember the stripes?
It's vertical. It's vertical stripe. Here's America's Prophet.
Okay.
I'm holding it up. There's Moses on the cover of the book.
I've seen that movie a million times. I don't remember. Anyway, so is it warm? Is it heavy? Is it nice?
It's kind of burlappy thing. I was amazed by how well made it. But the truth is, you know, it was also kind of quaint, because DeMille said everything was taken from ancient sources. That's kind of bollocks. A lot of it was invented. He sexed the whole thing up. I think it was the New Republic when the movie came out, called it Sexodus. He introduces this love triangle that was not clearly in the Bible. But for that reason, I think the movie ends up saying much more about America in the 1950s than Egypt in the 1250s BCE.
Do you wonder that there's never been a remake?
Well, I'm
just curious that there hasn't been.
Well, you've got the Prince of Egypt, the animated movie that came out in 1998. And by the way, that says a lot about America in the 90s, because it was all about sort of what our Muslim caller was saying earlier about how Moses is underappreciated and he just doesn't have the love of his father. I mean, it's very kind of like touchy-feely sort of Oprah America 1990s. And there are at least two movies in pre-production now. I don't know if they'll ever make it to screen, including one that's trying to do Moses 300 style as a kind of modern-day kind of animated action-adventure movie.
You can join our conversation. Call 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Let's go to Mark in Falls Church, Virginia. Hello, Mark. Welcome.
Good morning. You know, your conversation is a perfect segue to my comment. The words "proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the nations thereof," those appear in George Bush's second inaugural address. And when I heard them, I thought, gee, I said, is he trying to, or a speechwriter's trying to parrot Cecil B. DeMille and the Ten Commandments? And sure enough, Charlton Heston on top of the mountain in his parting scene, so those very words. So I can't help but wonder if that was a direct attempt to subliminally make an association with Moses as well.
Well, those words, of course, are on the Liberty Bell, and they come from a passage in the book of Leviticus that's very sort of overlooked. I mean, Leviticus is the least read and least loved book of the Bible. Most of it is filibuster that would, you know, maybe work on Capitol Hill today, but it's very tedious legislation. In the middle, there's this whole passage called the Holiness Code and the basic theme of it, and it's the most beautiful part of the Bible in a lot of ways, and it says, this is the part where it says we should attend the suffering, take the hurting into our arms, and uplift the infirm. And I think that those words were put there in all likelihood because it was the 50th anniversary of the state of the Commonwealth, I should say, of Pennsylvania. And they were not associated with liberty or with freedom. And it wasn't until basically the abolitionists 50 years later went back. They wanted to go around the Constitution, which, of course, enshrined slavery into American law, to the values of the Declaration. So they picked this word liberty, which, for the record, is a mistranslation. It actually should be release, proclaim release throughout the world. But they went back to that. And then so they then used the Liberty Bell. And we were talking earlier about women and women's rights. Suffragettes in the 100 years ago took the Liberty Bell. This is unimaginable, Michelle. On 11 different trips around the country and chained the clapper to the side and said, we will not ring this bell until women have the right to vote, even though the bell hadn't been rung in 100 years because it couldn't ring. But they were using it. And then the bell itself became this sort of icon. And it's much more popular than the Independence Hall today. It gets many more visitors, even though it's across the street. And Martin Luther King went there. Nelson Mandela went there. Gays have gone there. Jews looking for freedom for Jews in the Soviet Union. So again, it's this story of how Moses, the values sort of entered, became part of American values, and we've all gone back to it time and again in every troubled time.
Mark, thank you for calling. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
Let's go to Ed in Fort Worth, Texas. Ed, welcome. We were talking earlier about the whole question of the fact that the Bible, the story of Moses, is not as well known today as it was years ago, when pretty much everyone would know. Just I would not have had to ask a question.
Exactly.
Who is Moses? And Ed, I think you have something to say about that.
Yeah, what I was wondering is I have a student in school now, and the Bible just is not used in any way as a historical text in public schools anymore. And the concern that I have, and I don't know if you have it, is that recent generations are just losing the connection between American history, our culture, our politics, not only with Moses, but with other biblical figures and stories. And my wife and I were just discussing this morning how many sayings come from the Bible, and yet when you speak with young people, a lot of times they're really kind of at a loss and seem undereducated in this, to me, what's a very important area.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Ed, thank you for calling.
I agree with you, and right. I think that I think this is a lesson to both left and right, to be really frank about it. I think the biblical illiteracy, or maybe aliteracy, whatever words you want to use, America is essentially a biblical illiterate nation. We do not understand, we don't know the basic story, and we certainly don't know the connection between the biblical story and the American story. And I believe, we're sitting here now, and I know people hear this show in disjointed ways, but the previous hour was spent talking about Iran. And I firmly believe that we should teach the Bible, and I say this to left and to right alike, that we should teach the Bible in schools. I don't think think we should teach it as history necessarily. I might quibble with that because there's a lot of storytelling involved in here, and it may not be the most historically accurate text, but I believe it's important to the world, and understanding the Bible and understanding religion I think is central, because you can't, simply cannot go out into the world today and not be able to understand the relationship between religion and politics and contemporary
life. Very briefly, we only have a short minute before we have to take a break, but could you accept that if the Bible were taught as literature as apart from the theology? Would that be acceptable to you?
Yes,
I'm asking you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would like to see, to me, part of education is knowing not only the Bible, but as was mentioned, other great religious texts. And I think we're cheating our kids if we don't teach it as literature, and I think some part history. It is known as a great historical document. And I do think that we're cheating our kids by pretending somehow that the American culture and political body isn't connected to this document.
Amen.
Thank you for calling. And on that note, we need to take a short break. We are going to continue with your calls and with our conversation with Bruce Feiler. This is the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Michelle Martin, and sitting in for Diane Rehm. Please stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, director Terry Gilliam talks about his new movie, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Heath Ledger died while he was making it.
I was just destroyed, and I said, how do you finish a film when halfway through the star dies? It really was this feeling that how could we let Heath's last performance just vanish?
Terry Gilliam on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR's Tell Me More, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm visiting with Bruce Feiler, the New York Times bestselling author of 8 books. His latest book is America's Prophet, Moses, and the American Story. And I want to read just a couple of emails that have come in. I'll be very interested to hear your reaction.
Okay, here we go.
She writes, I used to admire Moses until I read all of the killings during the 40 years after the Exodus on his way to the Holy Land. Can you talk about that and why he went to war against all these tribes and kingdoms?
Well, I think that if you want to go back to what I was talking about earlier about Moses being a very human figure, he's got anxieties, he's got doubts, and there is definitely a strand of why are there 40 years in the desert, right? It doesn't take that long to get from Egypt to Israel. I've been myself over that territory dozens of times. By camel, it would take a week. By foot, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And it takes them 40 years. And I think that the answer is that the biblical story is about taking a people who are not ready to become a nation and turning them into a nation of laws. And so when you come out of, you cross the Red Sea, there's this period of lawlessness and chaos. There's not enough food to eat. There's not enough water to drink. There's suddenly all this opposition. They're not ready to face the opposition. And he has to go and get the Ten Commandments. And I think the messaging there is freedom depends on law. And so I think that that entire period, that interstitial period, if you will, that 40-year period, is about coming to terms with all of these things, the weaknesses of the people, the weaknesses of the leadership, trying to get, when they were passing the Constitution back in the 1780s, they said, oh, look, even he's got a community of elders like the Senate and a justice system, and in fact facing these oppositions, fighting these various battles. Because back in the ancient Near East, a god was very much associated with a group of people, and there were these wars. So even the Exodus itself is a way of God saying, my God is, are the people saying, my God is better than your God. So that this idea of the correlation between violence and God and politics that we are all facing today with the struggles of religion is very much reflected in the biblical story also.
But taking the other side of the story, the Moses story, one of the tragedies, if you will, is that Moses himself, after all he sacrificed, giving up family, giving up comfort, does not get to see the promised land. And of all the people that you wrote about, certainly Martin Luther King Jr., that aspect of not getting to see the promised land is something that resonated with him. But what, and in fact, one of the very famous speeches that he gave before the end of his life, which was, of course, tragically cut short, he talked about, I may not get there with you, but were there other leaders who connected with that part of Moses' story?
One of the surprising things about this journey of mine looking at Moses over several years was that in a lot of ways the Moses story is a failure narrative. And I hadn't really thought of it in that way, because for 40 years he puts up with their complaining and their kvetching, and then he doesn't make it to the promise. It seems an unimaginable tragedy. Now, in the biblical story, he gets something else. He gets a personal tour from God of the promised land. But this is one of the reasons. So you've got the pilgrims when they first came over here, and their leader, William Bradford, who quoted Moses all on the journey. Journey of the Mayflower. He becomes so mournful, he resigns the governorship and then starts studying Hebrew to get closer to Moses and writing these sort of mournful poems comparing himself to Moses. Certainly Abraham Lincoln, when he dies, the same thing, on the lip of the promised land in 1865. And so many of those servants, including Henry Ward Beecher, Harry Beecher Stowe's brother, in Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, not far from where I live now, talks about, you know, that there has never been another tragedy as great as the death of the leader, until, because he is not going to pass over to the promised land until now. And King, you mentioned on April 3rd, that the night before he is killed, he of course doesn't know he's going to be killed, he goes to the Mason Temple in Memphis. It's a stormy night. There's tornadoes across the river in Arkansas. He doesn't even want to go. And Abernathy and Andy Young get there, and they call him over from the Lorraine Motel. And he comes, and he gives this sermon. And he says, I have been to the mountaintop. I have seen, I won't do the voice that we can all hear echoing in our head, I've seen the promised land. I may not make it there with you, but we as a people will get there. And I read that to Andy Young, and I said, Ambassador Young, I don't usually have a hard time coming up with a question, but I got nothing to say. This is almost unbelievable. A man who was on the cover of a half a dozen different magazines saying America's Moses. This is unimaginable. And he said he'd heard Martin, as he called him, he'd heard Martin Luther King give that talk a number of times. And he said, Andy Young, to me, that King usually pulled himself out of the darkness, kind of by going humor and kind of dark gallows humor. But on this night, he didn't. He let the darkness linger. And what was interesting is what Andy Young said to me. He says, I would rather have died in his place on that balcony rather than try to go there without King at our side. But, he said to me, that's why one of the reasons that King is so popular today, with a national holiday, this prophetic figure in American life, beloved around the world, because somehow there is that idea that cut short of the promise makes him in some way a more exalted figure. And I think it's the same thing with Moses. If he'd gone into the promised land, it got messy. The people, you know, they regressed. All the things he warns them is going to happen is exactly what happened. So somehow on the lip of the promised land is such a powerful thing, because the ultimate role of the leader is not to make it to the promised land himself, but to prepare us to make it without him.
What about George W. Bush? You had a very interesting conversation with him, President George W. Bush, who summoned you to his office for did you get lunch?
I didn't get lunch. I got a call one day from my father, actually, on Valentine's Day saying, the President of the United States just mispronounced your name on national television. And he was at the end of an interview on C-SPAN.
Well,
and
he's never mispronounced mine, so excuse me.
He said,
sorry, boo-hoo.
Read any good books lately? And he said, yes, this book by this guy named Feeler about Abraham. And he mentioned my book on Abraham and how it's the Abraham is a shared ancestor of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Not long after I got this call would I come to the White House. So, you know, I hadn't exactly been a supporter of President Bush, but it seemed like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so I shined the shoes and pressed the suit and came down to D.C.
But the story of the reluctant leader resonated with him.
Well, first of all, the Bible. I mean, I asked him if he had a Bible in the Oval Office. He had one behind his desk. But he made a point of saying to me he didn't read it in the Oval Office, only in the private quarters. And then I said, Mr. President, nearly every one of your predecessors has been inspired by this story. Reagan gave an amazing speech on the 100th anniversary of Statue of Liberty, quoting Moses. And he told me that when he was inaugurated as the second time as governor of Texas, his preacher said Moses was not a man of words, and yet he was called to lead humanity. And what the president said to me was that his mother, Barbara, came up to him and said, you know, George, he's talking about you. And I think that idea of Moses as a human figure, why has Moses been in many ways more important to Americans than Jesus? Because Jesus is a sort of an other-like figure. You can't actually be a Jesus, as one Christian leader said to me, because he is a sort of God-like figure, whereas Moses is a more human figure, and his central task is to turn this small, oppressed people into a nation of laws. It's a fundamentally political transformation that he leads us through.
I want to save some time at the end to talk about some questions that people have about the relevance of Moses to our contemporary politics. I want to save some time for that, but first I want to go to Wynn in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Wynn, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting conversation. I wanted to mention the book Go Down, Moses by William Faulkner. People pronounce it typically Go Down Moses, but it's actually Go Down, comma, Moses, and it's an allusion to going down the mountain with the Ten Commandments. And a lot of folks think that that's Faulkner's best book, and it's really kind of an outline on how to live one's life. And then there's this great passage in The Bear about man's rape of the land, and I wondered if there was any comment or research on that book, and I'll listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm an old Faulkner hand, actually, having grown up in Savannah, Georgia. But to be honest, I haven't read Go Down Moses since I was a much younger man and thought about it in the context. But you mentioned the idea of the rape of the land in The Bear, and you have Faulkner, of course, living in Mississippi. And Moses was used quite a lot in the whole westward expansion of America. So in the same way that the West, so that Moses kind of became this lure for Europeans coming here back in the 17th and the 18th centuries, in the 19th century, he becomes a big lure for people going west. So Daniel Boone was very much modeled on Moses, talking about the Promised Land. The whole settlement of the Ohio Valley was definitely looked at as another kind of Moses movement into another untamed wilderness. And so the idea that in the Moses story they're going into, you know, we think about them as going into out of slavery into freedom, but the truth is they were leaving the most civilized place on earth, Egypt, for the most barren, the desert, based only on the word of a God they'd never actually seen. So much of the story in the biblical story is about the land, and it's about the desperation of being in this land with not a lot of water and not a lot of order. And so you talk about coming down the mountain, that key, and we just touched on it earlier, Michelle, is this, the idea that freedom lives in tension with law, that liberty in tension with responsibility. And there's no greater embodiment of that than the Statue of Liberty, because she's got the broken shackles at her feet and then the tablet of law in her hands. And so we shouldn't think of the story, and most Americans through history didn't think of it just as a story of freedom. They also thought of it as a story in law, and those two things are the great tension of American history.
I wanted to spend the couple of minutes that we have left talking about the connection of Moses to our contemporary politics. We got two comments through Facebook. The first from Lisa. While in seminary, the most amazing class I had was Moses, Man of God and Man of the People, which focused on the dual role Moses played, defending God to the people and the people to God, and using that as the role of pastors. It does give one hope to think that politicians might be aware of this balance as well. Moses was quite the politician. But we also got a note from Christopher saying that the influence that religion has had on American politics has probably done more bad than good. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
I'm not a believer in the idea that religion has done more harm than good. I simply do not believe that there is no America without this story. There is no America without religion. There is no America without biblical values. It also contains a warning, the Bible, and we were talking earlier about people using the Bible to defend slavery, but simply put, you cannot understand America without understanding this story. And so much of the great American values have their roots in biblical values. Values, and I think to try to separate them is a great disservice. The biggest wars of the 20th century were fought for godless secular ideologies, not for religious ideologies. And I think that just because religious extremism is something that we face today, we simply cannot tar all of religious impulses to those. And the truth is, my big feeling about this, it's become a theme of my life now for 10 years with Walking the Bible, Abraham, and now America's Prophet, is that we, and I think our conversation here embodies it. We have to get over that idea that our parents told us that you can't talk about politics and religion in public. We talk about politics all the time. And the truth is we have to talk about our relationship with God. We cannot let the extremists dominate the conversation. Those of us who believe in respect and tolerance, we have to speak out as well.
And I want to ask you about something that you wrote, which is you say that we are as much a nation of strangers today as at any time in our history and more in need of a unifying call Moses offers to free the suffering. How? You say if Moses could split the Red Sea, could he unsplit America? How? How?
We all live in a time where people say, you know what? People are going to have holiday gatherings. You know, I can't talk with my nephew because he doesn't know what made America great. Or my mother-in-law takes these stories far too seriously. What the Moses story shows us is that left, right, red, blue, Republican, Democrat, fat cat, communist, Christian, Jew have all used this story. And so what I'm trying to say in America's Prophet is that this is a person who has united us across time and across different ideologies. And perhaps if we talk about Moses, we can just for a second turn away from the conflicts of today, realize that we have shared values in our past, and so that maybe when we talk about the conflicts of today, and inevitably they'll come up, and that's fine. We understand that we have walked a shared road to get here, and that there still are common values in America, and that is what is lost in the polarized debate that goes on today, and you see it in Washington every single day. There is a shared American story. You cannot separate Moses from that story, and I do believe he can form the foundation of a national conversation.
How would that work, though? And I understand that you're not in the should business. You're not in the business of telling people what they should do. But how would that work for people who seem determined to see the other as the other, who seem determined not to see the common ground, to demonize those who don't agree with them about certain things? How would that work?
You're an African-American woman. I'm a white Caucasian male. I don't know what your religious background is. But we sit across these microphones, and it's transparent that we have different history that has brought us to this moment in time, just you and me, Michelle. But what have we just talked about for the last hour? The fact that parts of your past, parts of my past, parts of past that people aren't even in this room have touched on the same themes. And so what I'm saying is I find, and I've done it with interfaith conversations and now with political conversations in America, that if you just turn away from the past, from the present, just for a second, turn back to the past, talk about how we got here. By the time we get here, we're no longer perhaps sitting in opposition. We're sitting side by side. And it's not going to make the political debates go away, but it's just going to show us that we have a shared language. So at least when we're talking to each other, we are not convinced that we are demonized and forever in the opposite. The truth is, from the Pilgrims to the Founding Fathers, from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement, right up to this moment, in every troubled time in American life, people have turned back to the Exodus and to Moses for inspiration and hope. We are in a troubled time today, and perhaps maybe that can melt away a little bit of our conflict and allow us to realize that there is a shared conversation that has brought us to this moment.
And as you mentioned, we're both twin parents, so of course we share that. That's sort of marvelous and exhausting experience. So in all, we just have a couple of minutes left. In all of the journeys, you've had so many journeys that inform your work. And at first, I'm dying to know how the arrival of your twins has affected your work and what, of all the journeys that you've taken, what has been the one that stays with you?
Well, I spent wonderful years tracing through the Bible, looking at for Walking the Bible, and now this journey for America's Prophet. I've just come out of a personal journey. I spent the last year fighting cancer, and walked in here today with a cane because I had bone cancer, and I personally have spent the last year going through a trying time. And we've talked today about the power of the Moses story to say you can come from a constricted place and you can go to a more hopeful place. place, that to me is the core of the story. So what I tell my daughters is that what the Moses story is about, it is about the power of story. As Shimon Peres once said to me, the Egyptians built pyramids, the Israelites built stories. And it is a story of hope. This year, the Passover service says, we are slaves, but next year we can be free. And I think what it says, the story, and I tell my girls, is it says act. Take risk. It justifies, it evangelizes risk. Think of these people we've been talking about, the pilgrims, the founding fathers. These are ordinary people who found in the story something to make themselves great. So I tell my girls, plunge into the waters, persevere through the dryness, and don't be surprised if you fall short, because the true destination is not this year at all, but next.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and my very best wishes to you for your health and for the health of your family and your continued success in all that you do.
Thank you, Michelle. Happy holidays.
Bruce Feiler is the author, most recently, of America's Prophet, Moses and the American Story. He's the best-selling author of 8 books, including Walking the Bible, Abraham, and Where God Was Born. And he was kind enough to join us right here. And we thank him once again. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR's Tell Me More, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.